Good evening, everyone. Thank you all for joining, making some time on a Wednesday night. So I don't know, I don't think everyone was here last Monday night, but this is actually sort of, this year is meant to sort of be joined with this year from last Monday. So a brief review for those who weren't here, but that's totally okay. It will still be, it can still be appreciated. So last Monday, what I argued was that there are two different perspectives on tshuva and repentance. I think classically we associate tshuva with the world of action, right? Meaning repentance, or rather return, restoration, means if you did a bunch of things wrong, then there's a certain things you need to do in order to correct the wrongdoings that you did. And if we looked at the Rambam has a very clear list about how you do that. It's a very, you know, it's a procedure. There's a script that you say. There is things that you do. That's one perspective. And then what I argued was, based on Rav Kook, or Avram Yitzchak Kohen Kook, father, really, or one of the fathers of religious Zionism, and a very deep thinker, and he's very frustrated with this notion of tshuva. He's very frustrated with it. And to summarize his perspective in just a sentence, for Rav Kook, tshuva is primarily in the internal world of a person. It expresses itself in the world of activity, but primarily tshuva relates to our souls, our thoughts and our feelings, and the way we think and the way we perceive things. And it relates to the uniqueness of a person's soul. Therefore, Cook really refuses to give any particular script or procedure for how it is that one must do tshuva. For Cook, that's crazy, because the tshuva needs to fit the person. They go together. Tshuva is unlocking the holiness within a person's soul. It's restoring the way a person really is. It's the natural relationship a person should have with God and the world if things don't interrupt it. And you can't prescribe any particular method to accomplishing that experience. So I still stand by that. And that's going to be a theme. I think that tshuva needs to be for the person. However, it is a bit lacking in the following sense, and that is that we live in a practical world. And ultimately, you know, it's nice to talk about all this poetic language of reconnecting to one's soul and reconnecting to God, but what do I do? I remember Rabbi Strauchler actually asked me this at the end of the last shiur. He said, well, this is all very nice, but practically, what should you actually do? And so I thought this was a very good question. So today I thought, let's look at the practical side of things. What practical steps can we take to inspire improvement in our lives and in our souls? And again, to reframe it, for Rav Kook, and I still think this is true, it's not that these things are what you must do to do tshuva, it's that these things can help a person on their individual journey toward tshuva. And let me also just say, before we get into some of the sources tonight, that I'm speaking to myself as well. I clearly haven't perfected any of these things. And some of these things might work for you. Some of them may not. I really do think this is a personal journey. And different things work for different people. So in that vein, we're going to explore a few just from the generations. We're going to look at the thoughts of a number of different Jewish and one non-Jewish thinker tonight. And see how they approach this idea of tshuva. So at this point, I will share my screen. Hopefully everyone will be able to see. Okay. And I think the first point here, if you look at the bullet point, I tried to make this pretty organized and approachable, because this is meant to be practical, relate to our practical daily lives. That's the goal here. It's meant to be something that can be implemented. And I think the first notion here is an important one, and that is setting small, achievable goals. And this is true. The truth is, if you think about it, it's not necessarily intuitive. Meaning, a person can go to Yom Kippur, and there's like a whole, we look at our masor, there's a whole long list of things we did wrong. You know, and we spent a lot of Yom Kippur saying how horrible they all are. It's actually very self-defeating. You know, like, I'm so bad because I did this, and I did that wrong, 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 and I did that wrong. We do it five different times, right? And by the end of it, you could go out thinking, wow, I have so many things in my life I need to fix. And they're all really bad, and they're all really important, and I have to do them all. And Rav Kook here, and yes, we're going to relate to Rav Kook, because although he speaks very much in a sort of esoteric, internal way, he does relate to practical ideas as well. For Rav Kook says, it's never going to work that way. It'll never work. You can't do everything at once. To put it in a sort of different way, sort of another parable for this. So my daughter recently went to the dentist. And after you go to the dentist usually gives you a goodie bag, and that's very exciting. You get some toothpaste and a toothbrush and maybe even a toy. And then there's a paper with advice. And it has advice for, in terms of what you should do, like how you should brush your teeth and things like that. And also, the things you shouldn't eat, right? Now, what do you think is on that list? Let me ask you, what's on the list from a dentist of things that you shouldn't eat? What would you say? Simple question. You're a dentist. What would you tell a little kid not to have? That's pretty obvious. You can unmute. Yeah, candy, right?
Candy.
Exactly. Exactly. Bubblegum candy. So the advice is stay away from sweets. But here's what's interesting, and I think it's informative. It says specifically that doesn't mean don't have any. It doesn't mean don't have any, because what's going to happen if you say don't have any? No way! No way! No little kid's going to say, okay, that's it. The dentist said no more candy. Sorry, mommy and daddy. No more candy. The dentist, no kid can do that. That's not realistic. So you say, you try to limit what you have, right? That's the point. We'll get back to this later. So here's what Kook says here. I think it says it very powerfully. A person, and Rav Kook actually relates here to sort of this notion that you have this like inspiration, right? Maybe you go to this year, another year, you come out of Yom Kippur, you're a shun, and you're like, I'm so inspired. I have all these things I want to change. There's so much I want to do. And then you're thinking like, what do I do next? Okay, what do I do practically? Like, how do I bring this into my life? And he says, when a person wants, that all of their inner force, powers and emotions should be sanctified at one time. I'm going to change my whole life. Poof. I'm so inspired. Everything's going to be better now. Right? And that I recognize the truth. I've had an incredible elevation in my recognition and cognizance. I know what I should do in my life. It's all going to be different. And they want all the practical problems in their life to be straightened. I want everything to be fixed. I'm so convinced that I have to change my life. I want everything to be fixed. So Rav Kook says, Lo yimsal nafsho shuv ma'amad. They will not find for their soul any standing. It'll never work. It'll never work. And they will not be able to strengthen their will to walk the true path of perfection. And I think there's a point here that there's a word here he says it's really important. Ritzono. Ritzono means your will. And Rav Kook is saying here something that's really essential to keep in mind. Tshuva isn't, it has to be sincere. And for it to be sincere, you have to actually want to do it. It can't just be that you think it's the right thing to do. It has to be that you actually feel good doing it. There's only so much that you can struggle, right? You know, when I think about this, I think about like paying attention during davening, right? Like not, so that's something that I struggle with and I try to work on. And you go to davening, and every single time you open up your siddur, and what happens 2 minutes in? All of a sudden your mind's elsewhere, right? And I think sometimes, why is that? Like, I want to pay attention. You know what the answer is? Is because there's only so much that you can force yourself to do something that you don't really want to do. That's unpleasurable for you. That's just by force of will, it won't work. We have habits, and the reason that we have them is because we're accustomed to them, and also probably because we like them. There's something about them that we like, even if we know they're not the best for us. Rav Kook says, you can't push that. If you can't just say, I'm going to change everything in my life. Rather, Ella, what should you do? So first, you have to know. Aliyat hakara means you have to elevate your recognition. Know that you want to change and how you want to change. Habarat Torah Torah, yeah, the strengthening of the light of Torah. The inner world, it starts with the inner world. Vatshuva hamaset yismuchala, and the practical repentance will be close to it. Bechilab b'varim shalaba, first with the future, we'll get back to this. First focus on doing better in the future. Don't focus, we'll get back to this later, don't focus too much on the past. Just focus on doing better from now on. Vatshuva b'varim shalavar hanachatakin, and then eventually, you'll get back to fixing your mistakes from the past. And then the circle of perfection will expand and it will encompass those things which are very difficult to fix. And eventually, as the process continues, you'll end up perfecting or fixing everything. Don't move from the slow, gradual, spiritual journey that your soul demands from you. Your soul is only at a certain point. Don't push beyond your limits. You have to be realistic. Right, so that's point one. So, and I actually really like the way this source number two phrases this. So source number two is from Shlomo Volbe. Shlomo Volbe was a mashgiach in a number of very prominent yeshivot in the early and mid 20th centuries in Israel and Lakewood and elsewhere. And he's actually very, has a lot of psychological insight. And so here Shlomo Volbe talks about doing small things. Taking small measures, right? You want to work on not talking during davening. Pick one part of davening that you're never going to talk during, right? Small little things. That's what he says. And he actually has a really interesting point with it, right? Because usually when we try to break habits, as I said, there's an oppositional force. You're fighting against yourself. Right? You've been doing the other thing until now. Now you want to change. So there's a battle going on inside of you. And what he says is the smaller steps you take, the easier the battle will be. The bigger steps you take, then that force inside of you knows, oh, there's a big change going on. I don't want that to happen. Right? When we try to stop cold, that's usually what happens. If you say, I'm never going to do it again, then all of a sudden you have all these cravings. But when you say, right, it's with dieting also. If you try to cut completely, go cold turkey on eating something, and that often that's when you have the craving, and you just cut it out slowly. Yeah, Paul, did you have a question?
It seems that all of your comments are relating to you as an individual and things that you do.
Right.
For example, there are a lot of things that society benefits from that you may not benefit from. A true leader has to not worry necessarily about the individual things affecting the person, but maybe society as a whole.
Right.
So I don't buy the argument that you always look to yourself to make these changes. Sometimes the picture is much bigger than just yourself. Maybe your community, maybe your friends, and maybe your society, maybe your country. I mean, these things are just as important as individual things to you yourself.
Now, that's a good point. And I think I might relate to that later. And I think you're making a good point in terms of, like, if you have, you know, issues with relationships. But I think tshuva specifically, although it can relate to the country, as we talked about last week, but I think this change does start with you. You know, I think when we think about change, I think the changes start with the person themselves. You know, that's like a pretty famous theme. If you want to make a change first, start with yourself and then go to the world. So, but I'm not denying that's obviously true. We have societal and communal responsibilities, but I think tshuva specifically, even if it eventually relates to the greater community, starts with the person themselves. Is that fair?
Yeah,
Do you know what I'm saying?
I hear what you're saying. I'm looking at it from a leadership point of view. That
right.
The change that you want to bring to society may, in fact, be detrimental to you as an individual.
Ah, I hear what you're saying. You're saying it has to be good for you. That's fair. You're saying that I'm pointing out that you need to do it at your own pace, but sometimes you need to make it. You're saying sometimes you need to make a decision that might not be so good for you, but it's better for the society. That's fair.
Right.
That's fair. Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
On Paul's comment here, that's the way we have our Machzor written, because we bring in the plural of Shamnu, Bagadnu, Gazalnu, and but you see that's society, right? But really, when you read those words, right, it doesn't really, hit you hard, because if you didn't steal, if you didn't do these things, then you're praying for the society in general. You're not really trying to do tshuva as an individual. So
I think it's a balance. I think what we're saying is there's a balance between a person's own inner world and their own needs and their own individual journey, and also the needs of the community. And I think we balance both. I think there has to be a balance. The last point I'll make before, I don't think you can fully help the community if you neglect yourself. I think that's really important also, that a person who wants to be a leader but neglects their own individual needs, then they won't be there. They won't have their full self to help the community. It doesn't mean that there isn't ever a need for sacrifice, but I think both are important to focus on. Anyway, I just wanted to point this. Rav Volbihar has a great parable, and he says as follows. He was once on a flight. You can read it inside, but I'll say it outside. He was once on a flight to Egypt right after the Yom Kippur War. And he says he's on this plane, and the plane starts to fly very low to the ground. Very low to the ground. And he gets a bit worried, like, why are we flying so low? This isn't good. Is something wrong with the technology? Is there a problem with the plane? And so we asked someone, and they said, well, again, this is a bunch of years ago. It might be different nowadays. But at the time, Egypt and Israel weren't the best allies. And the pilot says to him, whoever it was that talked to him, says, it's not such a good idea to let Egypt know that a Jewish plane is coming in. So we fly low, because the lower if we fly below the radar, that's a phrase, below the radar won't pick us up. And so Rav Volbi says, it's the same thing when you want to make a change in your life. The higher you reach, the more that rebellious opposition inside of you, those cravings are going to push back. The more you say, I'm going to change everything. If it's a diet, I'm never going to eat that again. Then that part of you, which was eating it until now, was going to push back. If you make a small change, if you fly below the radar, then they can't pick it up. Then there's a very little pushback. And then you build on that incrementally.
Toads in the boiling pot, it's the same thing, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Step by step. That's the first point. Small steps. That's our first little tip here. Relating to this, and I think this is also important, we mentioned it before, Rav Kook argues that we shouldn't focus at first on the past when we do tshuva. And I think this can work for the community as well, to Paul's point. Often, and I think this, we really relate to this in the realm of relationships. That, I'm sure this is happening, tell me this happened to you, it certainly has happened to me, where, you had a relationship with someone when you were younger, and you end off on, like, a bad note. There's, like, one particular conversation or occurrence that happened that didn't go so well. And, like, the next time you see them, there's a certain stigma, because you don't want to... You don't know how to address that thing that happened in the past. Whatever it was, it might have even happened 20 years ago. It might have been some innocuous thing, but at the time, it was a big deal. And sometimes, because of that, you don't want to even address them. You sort of awkwardly walk by them when you see them. And I think it's that way a lot of times when we look at things we want to change, we think, oh my gosh, all those things I did wrong, there's so much I need to correct, I don't even want to deal with it. Because it's just so overwhelming to think about it. I think that as a community, this is true sometimes also. You know, it could be that there's a certain initiative the community had that went very badly in the past, and there's like a certain stigma with that whole initiative, and therefore they don't even want to think about revisiting it in the future. And Rav Kook says, sometimes it's worth not even focusing on the past. Forget about the past. Just focus on making it better in the future. Don't think about how sorry you are for what you did. That's overwhelming. There's a lot of emotional baggage with that. Focus on here on in. He says, Yisora Shuvah in source number 3, Sarich lo'olam liyot munach al ha'tikun shel ha'ba. The foundation of tshuva needs to be placed on fixing the future. In the beginning, don't put so much focus on what has happened in the past. If you think too much or immediately about fixing what has happened in the past, if I think too much about, again, what we see in the Yom Kippur Maaser right away, I messed up on this past year, I did this wrong this past year. When you think about that, that hurts. It's heavy. That's a heavy obstacle to overcome. And then it's going to be hard to do tshuva. Tshuva isn't, you're not supposed to make tshuva harder than it has to be. You don't need to make it the hardest it can be right away. You can approach it gradually. Aval b'yotzo asuk be'emel tagein ma'asa, Rav Kook says, if you say, sincerely, I want to improve in the future. Hadavar muftach she'az yazru min hashemayim gan kinat tzakana avar. It's he says guaranteed. That's what muftach means, although I think it's a bit strong. It's guaranteed that you'll have divine assistance in even fixing the past. If you sincerely say in the future I want to be better, then Hashem will help you. Worry about the past too. So I think then this is sort of in the same vein, not doing anything too crazy. However, the next perspective from the Rambam sort of has the opposite perspective. And again, when it comes to practically implementing tshuva, it really depends on what works for you. Some people might adopt this first approach, others might take the Rambam. What the Rambam sounds like he's saying here is that if you want to make a change, you got to shake things up. I don't know if it means your behavior, but sometimes getting out of a certain, routine, just changing something up that you notice helps create change in your life. If it means, if it might mean dressing differently, he gives a few examples, read in a second. It might mean going somewhere else that you don't always go, where nobody knows you. Because I feel that sometimes we have a certain social expectation from our friends and peers, and they expect us to act that a certain way, and we act that way because that's who we're supposed to be. And when you go to a new environment with people that don't really know you, you have more freedom to be who you want to be. But sometimes you just gotta shake it up, shake up that environment. Take a look at the Rambam here. Midarchei tshuva, and this isn't what isn't integral to tshuva, but this is the way of tshuva. Liot hashav tzoeg tamil nei Hashem, to scream in front of God, b'vchi v'tachanunim, by crying. V'oset tztaka kafi hocho, and to do tztaka, to as much as they can, and mitrachik harbe min hadavar shachatabo, and to distance yourself a lot from the sin. You did something wrong, stay away from it. I guess to give a simple example of a person knew that they sinned through eating something they shouldn't have eaten, so don't even go near it. Just go far away. Umishana shmo, and a person changes their name. Klomar, ani acher ve'ini otoa isha sa'otona ma'asim. And I think he literally means change your name. Start calling yourself a different name, just as if to show yourself, I'm not that same person. Umishana ma'asim kulam le'tovan, change everything for the good. Derech Sharva, the golem mimikomo, go elsewhere, move to a different place. Shegalot mechaperet avom mipnei shegaremet lo likana linot afav anavishvaruach. By when you go into quote unquote exile, when you go somewhere else, that is a certain atonement in that. So all these are pretty extreme, I would say, for the Rambam. Changing your name, change where you are, change everything, big changes. And it's not necessarily what we've been saying until now. It's a different approach. But I think the idea is shake yourself out of that routine, out of that rote activity that led to the behavior trying to change. Just do something. It can even be like, it doesn't need to, I don't think that it needs to be completely remodeling your behavior. It could be something that stands out to you. You know, if it's, you know, if it's a certain way that you dress, just to do something to change up the way that you act. Change up your routine. Wake up a little bit earlier. You know, just 2 minutes, 5 minutes earlier. Just to show that you're trying to make a difference. And I think to get out of the rote, this can be a helpful perspective. So that's number two.
You have to make sure that if you cause damage by your previous behavior, that damage has to be rectified before you can move on.
I agree with that, 100%. I agree with that. That's a good point. This is a good point. So, I mean, I think that a lot of what we're saying, when it is damage, I think that's something that is a pretty concrete way of addressing a problem, right? So yeah, 100%. I agree with that point. Okay, so another point here, I think this is an interesting one. And I'll tell you, personally, that Rabbi Strauchler and I were talking, and I mentioned to him, I mentioned even in a shir, something I'm trying to work on is to become more prompt to davening, to come on time to davening, to be a little bit early, not to walk in a few minutes late. It's a struggle for me. I don't know. Some people are naturally punctual. I'm sure my dad is chuckling, although I can't see him right now. And some people are naturally not so punctual. It's just a struggle. And Rabbi Strauchler said to me, "Oh, I could be your chavrusa. We can if there's anything I could do to help encourage you." And I think that sometimes having a peer supervision or working on something with someone else is very helpful. It's comforting. We work on this together, and it helps to have someone who's paying attention to you. You're not on your own in this. To work on things in groups. It doesn't need to be the most personal thing, but let's all work together on coming to the davening on time, or let's all work together. We're gonna have watching the way we speak. When you're doing it with a group, there's a certain positive peer pressure that strengthens you to make that change. And that's what Rabbi Rabbeinu Yonah says here in source number 5. Derech yishara sheyavor ha'ad lo ha'adam li'irat shamayim liknono chaver achad ha'rabim ledaberi mahem tamim li'irat shamayim. A clear path toward improving in one's fear of heaven is to get a friend or many friends to talk with them about fear of heaven. And if one of the group makes a mistake, or they sin, or they're missing something, the other will warn them and reprimand them. And remind them the way of mitzvot. And he mentions specific things, so remind them about putting on tefillin, and not to speak irrelevant topics in the sanctuary. Believe it or not, even 800 or so years ago, they used to have problems with talking in shul, even in the time of Rabbeinu Yonah. It's not a new 21st century phenomenon, or it's been around forever. So Rabbeinu Yonah says, you're talking in shul, okay, let's have a group. And again, we're not going to talk in shul. We're going to remind each other, and if I end up slipping and I end up, I say, "How's it going? How was your week?" So you remind me. And I think I want to point out here that there's a certain stigma sometimes to telling people, even our friends, that for some people, I'll say, for some of us who are a bit more unassuming, there's a certain stigma, a certain reluctance to tell people to do anything. There's a certain respect to give any sort of even encouragement, because who am I to tell you what to do? But I think if we, have a group in advance, and you say to a friend, "Listen, we're going to, if I start doing X, Y, or Z, could you remind me? Because it's just hard for me." Just wink. Then that's helpful. It removes that stigma. That's our group. But that's what we do. We remind each other about not talking during davening. Again, it's the same 800 years ago. Specifically when the chazan goes over the Shmoneh Esrei during the chazan's repetition. because that's the perfect time to talk, because you already prayed. So, like, you know, the Chazan's doing his own thing. Now I can catch up with my friend on the week's occurrences. So we can remind each other. That's what we'll do. This is from this passage is from the work Rabbeinu Yonah calls the letter about tshuva, and they'll remind each other. He says to read this letter about tshuva. And they'll ask each other, "Oh, what did we read this week in this tshuva letter?" And if they find there are certain things they're not doing, they'll encourage each other. This is a thing that can greatly contribute to success in repentance and doing good things. And it's beloved to heaven. And he quotes pasuk from Malachi, "As nidbaru yirei Hashem ish el re'ehu." Then this is actually talking about when Mashiach comes. Those who fear God will talk to each other. They'll talk to each other, one man to his friend. And getting sort of back to Paul's point, and I think certainly if we're talking about a communal issue, even a leader, it helps to have a peer group to talk about things. Like, how are we going to together help the community? The more, it's lonely to do tshuva. It can be a lonely process. It can be overwhelming. There can be certain feelings of a lack of security or confidence. When you have a group of people who are encouraging each other, that can really help issues. So that's another interesting thing. So now, we get to a point. Again, these are all, each of these can work for you, not work for you. They're just different insights that these sages have. So now, here's probably one of the most surprising things, but I actually found it quite interesting. So Rav Kook, I'll tell it to you outside, and then we'll read it inside. Rav Kook says, this is the only practical thing that I found, that he says you have to do, a specific instruction to do in his book. And he says, if you want to learn, or you want to start to do tshuva, learn business law. Learn the laws about business ethics. Why do you think that is? Anybody have an idea? Why would Rav Kook say that a way to get a person on the path of repentance is to learn about the laws of business? The practices of business. Yeah, Chaim.
Be honest between people. It'd be easier to be honest with God, but it's very easy to be honest with God but dishonest with other people.
Okay, so being honest with others is a step to being honest with God. Good. That's certainly part of it. Yeah.
There's actually three places in the Torah that God will say you've got long life for. And one of those places happens to be one that you never learn in school. We know about kibud avaim. We know about
Shiluach HaKohen,
the baby birds, the mother bird. But the third one is business. The third one happens to be that you shall have proper weights and measures.
Right.
For a long life.
Right.
There's only three of them in the whole Torah that give you a reward. A long life reward specifically. And that one has to do with business.
So why do you think that is?
Well, it's... To me, it's...
What's so important about having those weights?
In Torah words, it's weights and measures, but it really means in business. I mean, you've got to be honest with people you deal with in business. You can't hide yourself from you can't be dishonest. If you're dishonest to others, you're negating everything that the Torah stands for.
Very good. So I think you're on along the lines he's going to say here. And I'd like to frame it in the following way. For Rav Kook, again, tshuva is primarily, or at least initially, an internal process. It's something, it's a way that you think, it's a cognizance that you want to be more true to yourself and true to God. So then the question always arises, how do I bridge my internal world, who I want to be, and practically who I am, how I act. And Rav Kook says, along with Charlie is saying, when you think about the laws of business, what is it about? It is about making sure that justice is practiced in a very real way in the world. And the laws of business, the laws and Choshen Mishpat, and then there are a lot of them, and they're in, and what's amazing about this is, he doesn't say, you know, like when you think about things that you learn to inspire you, you're not going to necessarily think about, I don't know, something like, if I do a business deal with someone and I back out in the middle, do I owe them any money? Right? But the thing is, when you try to think of that question, right? Reuven promised to lend Shimon money. Shimon relied on that. And he did something because of that. Now Shimon doesn't have the money. He lost out because of that. Is he have to pay Reuven or not? When you think about those questions, you know what you're asking? What is the proper way to practically implement justice? That's what you're asking. That's what business law is all about. And Rav Kook says, in Rav Kook's world, that's the perfect way to bridge. If you ever learn Talmud about business law, it's very incisive reasoning. It cuts to the core of the issues and the issues that lay at the foundation of making justice work in this world. And so when a person does tshuva, they have this inner desire to make things in the world better. Not just for themselves even, everything in the world. Rav Kook says, learn about a way to, in practice, do that. And I think business is a great way of doing it, but it could be, I think, another way to inspire change. Learn about something practical that interests you. Any halachot or law or anything that you find interesting that you can actually apply in your life. Even if it doesn't relate to anything specific you did wrong. It could be, but any time where you're invested intellectually in understanding how to practically act on a daily basis in your life, so that bridges your internal desire to do good with your practical activity. And that is an incredible way of doing tshuva here. I'll read part of this inside. It's very poetic. Rav Kook says as follows here. Derech ha-tshuva ha-yoter mikorit v'tova. The most original and good way of doing tshuva, hanovat me'ora Torah bo'olam, which emanates from the lay of Torah in this world, he has shinun b'chelek dinei mamanot, is studying monetary law. V'chol mishpatim shbinam l'chaveril, as Chaim said, and all the interpersonal laws, haklulim etzlin b'lim choshen mishpat, which are included in what we call choshen mishpat, which is the section of the law, which is business law. Right? Which, with all the intellectual analysis and incisive thinking and expertise that's necessary, right? Business law is complicated. You need to really think it through. There's problem solving involved. That's all important. He mitakenet et kol mikshulei halev shebechayim umamida et atzedek elokia basiso haneman. It fixes all the obstacles of the heart in life and stands up the godly justice on its base. That when you think of, what are you thinking about? I'm thinking clearly and incisively about how to implement justice. That thought process and how it relates to the practical life can be very transformative. And he adds here, I'm not going to read the whole thing inside now, but he adds that it has to indeed be a combination. It has to be, if you just learn business law like you were as if it was a law textbook without the context of trying to under the desire to implement justice in this world, then it won't necessarily affect you. But if you do it as an expression of your internal desire that I want things to be just, that's what tshuva ultimately is. I want everything in the world to be the way it's supposed to be. I want things to be fair and equitable and moral for me and for everyone. And then you take that desire and you implement it by learning the law of how to implement justice, so that in and of itself can be very transformative. So, Yeah.
I mean, people walk into shul and they come with an outfit, and then the next week they go and screw someone else's business. I mean, business ethics are just, they're at the bottom of the barrel these days. They really are.
I hear you. So we should, we gotta... It's a problem. I think you're arguing for of Cook, not against him. Right? I think you're making the point that, business ethics are very important in terms of justice, and people are neglecting them. That's a problem.
Right, so people don't see it, so we should put more emphasis today on teaching people business ethics.
I agree. Rav Cook would certainly agree. He thinks it's the best possible thing you could do tshuva.
So
Sherishimai
should have a course on business ethics.
Okay, okay. Put that. I'll certainly keep that in mind. I hear it. I will tell you, Paul, that last year in the Beit Midrash, we had a whole year on employment law and breaking agreements and keeping them and what happens and such stuff like such as this. So you're welcome to check those out. But I agree with you. I just want to point out how novel this is. If you would ask a typical person on the street, what should I learn? What should I study if I want to get close to God? If I want to improve? I don't think anyone would say business ethics, right? People wouldn't. It's not the first thing that they would say. That's what Cook says, because it's practical. It's real. It exists in the world. You have to think about what is just, what is right, and then go and do it. So I found that very enlightening, actually. So the last thing I want to share is very interesting. I found very interesting. So there's a bit of a background with this. So I want to share a few thoughts from Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin, who was one of the founding fathers of the United States of America. I know we're here in Toronto, but you know, I think we could all have admiration and for people who had wisdom. And you might think, well, why are you talking about Benjamin Franklin in a Torah class? What does Benjamin Franklin have to tell us about tshuva? So, to the answer, so first of all, we say that if there's wisdom, we should seek wisdom wherever it's found. But the truth is, I'm not the first, I am certainly not the first person to quote Benjamin Franklin in this context. In fact, as we'll see in just a minute, Rav Yisrael Salanter, who was the father of the Musar movement, the father of studying and practicing implementing ethics and morals in life. He really pioneered the system of learning works that are not geared toward knowledge of law, but rather geared toward inspiring people to make changes in their life in terms of their character traits and their ethics. He also studied or implemented some of the ideas of Benjamin Franklin. So I want to end off with that, because I found it very interesting. It's very systematic. But before we get to Benjamin Franklin, I just want to point out that this notion we're going to talk about is in earlier Jewish sources as well. And that is the notion of a two-step process to systematic change. Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, or Ramchal, in the famous work Mesillat Yesharim, has two important steps that a person needs to take or should take in order to really implement change in their lives. The first step, one, defining your values. Defining the way, the most important principles that you want to live your life by. What are the most important things to you on a daily basis? What are the character traits that you want to embody in the way that you live? That's step one, define the values. Step two, determine whether you're actually living by those values. In a systematic way. He actually says, whether it's daily or weekly, take the time to review the things that you've done and to check whether or not you've actually lived up to the values that you've defined for yourself. Take a look here at source number 7. Haneh ha-rotzeh lefakeach la'atzmo, shtayim hineh ha-heshkafot ha-tzricho lo. A person that wants to watch over themselves, they need to have two perspectives. Step one, define for yourself what is the ultimate good that you need to follow and what is the ultimate evil you need to avoid. That's step one. Hashniyah, The second step is, once I've defined those values, to see whether or not my actions live up to those values. That means when you're actually in the act and when you're not in the act. When you're doing it, before essentially think before you act, to be thoughtful and not impulsive, that before you say, and there are a lot of people that are pretty well known nowadays who would really do very well to follow this advice, that before you say or do or tweet or post anything, think about whether what you're about to say or do or tweet or post is consistent with your values. That's step one. That's very hard to do. But it's generally being a thoughtful person. Bishalo bishat ma'asen, even when you're not acting, she'alelefanav zichron kal ma'asav v'yishkolotam, that you go at the end of a day or a week and think about all the things that you did, which requires writing some of them down, and decide whether or not you're generally living up to your values. To determine, what are the things that I'm doing that I need to get rid of or change? And what are the good things I need to continue doing? Right, evaluation. It's a simple evaluation. We do evaluations sometimes of peers or, you know, people evaluate our work. Why don't we evaluate our general behavior? If you find something you're doing wrong, then think about a tactic, an approach. How am I going to stop? How am I going to do it better? So this is the general approach, a systematic approach to improvement. Define your values and practically test whether or not you're living up to them. To do an accounting, we call in Hebrew, a cheshbon hanefesh. So this is the Mesilat Yesharim, Rosh Chaim Lutzato, hundreds of years ago. Benjamin Franklin really took this, I think, to the next level. He developed a systematic way of doing this. Take a look here in source number 8, right? Barrow Wine just notes that, for whatever reason, Benjamin Franklin became a pretty important player in the Musar movement. It says here, one of the strange quirks in history is that Rabbi Salanter, that's the father of the Musar movement, and the followers of his Musar movement, were strongly influenced by Benjamin Franklin. Franklin's personal life leaves much to be desired. However, his ideas were extraordinary in many respects. The 1700s, Ben Franklin had published Poor Richard's Almanac, which includes in it a great deal of philosophy. In it, he listed 13 famous character traits, which he said are the foundation of a good person and a good society. Included in the list are such traits as thrift, honesty, silence, and study. We'll see the 13 traits in just a few minutes. So he defined 13 traits he wanted to live his life by. And then he actually went each week, picked a trait, and at the end of the day, marked off all the times he didn't live up to it. We'll see in a minute. He just points out the history behind this. A Lithuanian Jew by the name of Menachem Mendel Lefin had traveled west and studied in the universities of Germany and France. There he read the writings of Benjamin Franklin and became greatly influenced by them. He wrote a book of Jewish ethics based on Franklin's ideas, almost quoting him verbatim, but never mentioning his name. It was as though it was his book. Do I think that's plagiarism? Very possibly. Am I going to defend it? No, I am not. I am not going to defend it. Maybe that isn't good business ethics. I imagine he did it this way because he didn't think that the Jewish world would accept wisdom from some person in America named Benjamin Franklin. But that's not the point. The point is Benjamin Franklin clearly impressed him, so it became a Jewish book. Then Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, this very important, prominent rabbi, read his book, was very impressed by it, and he publishes it in Kovno using his own funds, and it's been published a number of times. So basically, Benjamin Franklin's book became a Musar book. That's what ended up happening. Why? Because it really, truthfully, is a very systematic way of doing what we just described. So if you look here, I'm not going to read the whole thing for you inside, I'm going to focus on the traits, but what he says is some of the things that we've shown until now. Good. Benjamin Franklin talks about how, we'll just get to the traits themselves, how originally he said, look, why don't I just change everything? I'm just going to change my behavior. I don't get it. If I know what's right and I know what's wrong, why shouldn't I just act that way? Why shouldn't I act like it? Why shouldn't I do what's right and not do what's wrong? And then he realized it's not so simple. he realized that we have habits and that we have appetites and passions. And to simply say, I'm going to always do what's right, doesn't always happen. So instead, he wrote out on a paper the virtues he wanted to live his life by, and he had a schedule of testing whether or not he lived by those virtues. I think they're very good. I think, let's go in through quickly. Number one, temperance, meaning self-control. Eat not to dullness, drink not to elevation. Silence, watching what you say. Order, right? Doing everything at the right time in the right place. Not being disorganized and doing things in a disorderly fashion. Resolution, which means if you decide something is right, do it. Don't say you're going to do something and not do it. And resolve to do the things you think you should do. Frugality. I think this is kind of similar to temperance, but don't spend unnecessarily. And you can look at that. Industry, using your time appropriately, being truthful and honest, sincerity, justice, don't do harm to others, moderation, which I think is pretty similar to temperance and frugality. But again, be having the self-control, cleanliness, tranquility, chastity, and humility. I'll just point out, if you look at humility, he says, we know what humility means. He says, imitate, I wrote dot, dot, dot. He picks his own role models. I don't think we would choose the same role models. So you can find your own role model of who's a humble person. But this is the first point. The first point is he found the virtues he wanted to live his life by. Then look what he says. My intention being to acquire the habitude of all these virtues, I judge it would be well not to distract my attention by attempting the whole at once. I'm not going to try to do all 13 at once, but to fix it on one of them at a time. And when I should be master of that, then to proceed to another and so on until I should have gone through the 13, and as the previous acquisition of some might facilitate the acquisition of certain others, I arrange them. Meaning some lead to others, so I did it in an orderly fashion, in a way that makes sense. Then he says, I made a little book in which I allotted a page for each of the virtues. I ruled each page with red ink so as to have 7 columns, one for each day of the week, marking each column with a letter for the day. I crossed these columns with 13 red lines, marking the beginning of each line with the first letter of one of the virtues, on which line in its proper column I might mark by a little black spot every fault I found upon examination. And you take a look at here, he has temperance. And he has, right? Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And he makes a dot every time he messes up. This is a very, like, doable type of thing. And it seems sort of like, you know, amateur. But it really might work to really make an accounting in a real way. Did I live up to my values today? Because what could be more important than knowing what your values are and seeing whether you're actually living up to them? So Benjamin Franklin, I think, has a lot to teach us here about how to improve, how to live up to our values. First of all, defining them, and second of all, living up to them. So again, just to sort of summarize briefly, and then we'll call it a close. I think the ultimate point is that, and Paul's point is a good one, but when you focus on improving, you have to improve in a way that is consistent with who you are. And there are a lot of different ways to do that. But again, I don't think tshuva can be forced. The point isn't to make yourself do a whole bunch of things you don't really want to do. Every once in a while, you have to do something you don't want to do because it's the right thing to do. But I don't think that can be a general approach. If you're constantly doing things that you're not ready to do, you're going to burn out, you're going to run out of willpower. Rather, you need to approach improvement in a way that works for you, that is the most natural and organic. And we just mentioned a few different ways to do that. Taking small steps, right? Small achievable goals. Looking to the future if necessary and not getting caught up with the emotional baggage of the past. We focus on shaking up the environment. Another way, just changing something noticeably different about your life, you know, to inspire change. Having a peer supervision group, encouraging others to discuss the ways that you want to improve your life, the things that you want to focus on. You know, having a group of people to talk about those things with. We talked about the practical study and Rev. Cook, you know, focused on business law, but I think it's any practical study where you can use an expression of your will and desire to improve in a practical way in your life. And finally, a systematic approach to improvement, defining what your values are and actually assessing whether you are on a daily basis or weekly basis living up to those values. I will say for myself that I certainly have not perfected any of these, but I do hope as I talk to myself along with you that I could take one or two of these things and maybe to implement one of them, make a small change, you know, toward improvement in my life. And I hope we can all do that, implement real lasting change in a way that feels good and as we approach the new year. And hopefully it can be an incremental process of growth until we continue to grow and achieve and become the best people that we can be. So I'll take, we have a few minutes for questions. Thank you all very much for joining and have a wonderful week. Yeah. So we have Paul and Charles. Can I call on Charlie first, Paul? I think he, yeah. Go for it. Please.